Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
All the fuss about steroids has always struck me as a little silly. Of course, if you're ripped like I am, essentially a towering monument to muscle, you don't need steroids. They'd be not only potentially dangerous, but superfluous. And that's why I work in radio. But seriously, folks, Shauna Sale's new book, Steroid Nation, tells us all we need to know about steroids and perhaps some things we'd just as soon not have known, such as the story of the ex-football player and infamous steroid abuser who discovered one day while signing autographs that he was, in fact, drawing circles. I began my conversation with Shauna Sale with a reference to the apparently steroid-enhanced subtitle of his book, which is Juiced Home Run Totals, Anti-Aging Miracles, and a Hercules in Every High School, The Secret History of America's True Drug Addiction. I asked Mr. Sale to define addiction in this context.
I just think that we're addicted to wanting to look better, wanting to live longer, wanting to do better in sports, and wanting to get an edge. And what the book does is it tries to explore this astounding drug that's sort of at the crossroads of optimism and avarice.
When most sports fans hear steroids, they probably think of sprinter Ben Johnson or perhaps wrestler Chris Benoit, baseball's Jason Giambi, various East German women, and most recently Marion Jones. But your book really begins with a story of a guy named Dan Duchesne. Why is that?
Bill, I had written another book about wrestling a few years ago, and when I wrote about that, I came across something called the Underground Steroid Handbook, which was a kind of an I Ching for the Gold's Gym crowd in Venice in the early 80s. And it was interesting to me because it was where the sort of steroid religion started, and I became fascinated by who wrote this anonymous pamphlet that was only 17 pages and on cardboard stock, but it listed every drug and what those drugs did. And I wound up finding the authors, one of whom was still alive, one of whom was dead, and Dan Duchesne is no longer with us. And what I realized is that was a gateway to an entire culture, and I spent the next 3 years writing and reporting about that culture.
Of the 84 games in Los Angeles, you write that Don Catlin, who was responsible for testing athletes there, felt that the U.S. Olympic Committee had, quote, put itself and Catlin in bed with the perpetrators. How so?
You know, for the longest time, really until 2000, America had a very uneasy relationship with athletic cheaters in its midst. And one of the ways that the USOC tried to deal with it was to give them a sort of a pass. You know, if they tipped off a test, they'd get a warning and a kind of don't do this again tap on the wrist. And essentially what that did was it just gave them a chance to find the right level so that they wouldn't get caught by the tests being used.
You write that human growth hormone was so prevalent at the 96 Olympic Games that people called the spectacle the HGH Games. Is the policy for testing Olympic athletes more efficient and more effective now than it was in Los Angeles and in Atlanta?
Yeah, I mean, part of what the book does is it looks at the arc between the early days of Anything Goes in the gyms of Venice and a community I call sort of the Arnoldistas. And as we go forward, we see how each few years there are these epochal moments. One epochal moment was the Ben Johnson scandal that created these hearings in Canada, the Dubin Commission hearings, that really opened our eyes. And that begat laws in America. And by 2000, you had this cycling scandal and wrought by Festina, and that created the World Anti-Doping Agency. So now we have these police agencies, these anti-doping police agencies that are really patrolling the Olympic landscape a lot better.
To what extent has the overlap between steroids and various nutritional supplements complicated the challenge of outlawing steroids?
Bill, it's just made it harder and harder. I mean, I've just done a story based on the book for ESPN the magazine showing that right now a supplement, you can buy steroid-laced supplements over the internet. There was a 1994 law that tried to liberalize supplement sales. It created a whole lot of mischief. It's a real problem now, Bill.
But several points in the book, you compare the manufacture and sale of steroids to the production and distribution of alcohol during Prohibition. On balance, have the laws against steroid use been useful or counterproductive?
I think that one of the things that I argue in the book, and I argue it through storytelling, is that steroids, the very term has become a little bit like terrorism. It's been used so broadly that it almost sort of stops having any nuanced meaning. I think that the laws that we have now are terrific with respect to kids. I mean, there's all sorts of medical mischief that happens when kids use these things. But there's a real uneasy relationship with the anti-aging community. And I think that we need to take a second look at whether our laws are right with respect to personal choice and whether people should be able, you know, in their 40s and 50s to take some of these things if they want to feel better and feel younger.
Medical mischief may set off some alarm bells, especially among families where, you know, youngsters have really gotten in trouble with this stuff, sometimes to the extent that they've killed themselves.
Yeah, I mean, there's one of the known side effects of you know, steroid usage is mood swings, especially when you try to taper off. The last thing teens were already going through these things. I mean, I have a teenager at home. The last thing they need is any more mood swings. But more than that, the last thing they need is to try to flood their body with hormones at the time where their body's making their maximum number. What happens is it forces your body to sort of reduce its natural output to accommodate the synthetic input. And that has some real long-term consequences, and I think families need to talk about that.
Considering the current state of the science of doping, drug testing, the penalties for those who are caught, and whatever other variables you might feel apply, is there any less incentive to use performance-enhancing drugs now than there has been in the past? I'm talking now about among professional athletes and top amateur athletes.
Well, I do think that you know, the minimum 4-game bans in football and the 50-game bans in baseball are having some effect with respect to anabolic steroids. I think it is a deterrent effect. I think the next frontier is human growth hormone. We're seeing that now in a number of pharmacy scandals. I write about them in Steroid Nation. And I think you see now, because the pro leagues will not allow blood to be taken, that the only workable HGH test, which is a blood test, is not being used in pro sports. So I do think that that's now being widely used.
Did you end up coming away from this with some sort of sense of, I don't want you to pull a Jose Canseco here and give me a guess that's you know, his kind of guessing, but do you have a sense of how prevalent human growth hormone is in either the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball, wherever?
You know, I think that sports is really just a reflection of society, and one of the things the book does is takes a look at how we're in love with anti-aging medicine and how the anti-aging clinics and doctors are springing up everywhere, and I think sports is a reflection of that. I think that a goodly number of players trying to extend their careers in their 30s and into their 40s are using. I don't know that the younger players are. I don't want to put a percentage on it, but I think it's significant.
At times when it was tough for suppliers of steroids to get the makings, Dan Duchesne, who numbered scores of NFL players and trainers among his clients, provided advice about how folks could get the ingredients themselves. What did he suggest?
You know, Dan, and this is really one of the most remarkable things about the book, the extent to which Dan influenced so many prominent people, that, you know, he was one of the first to, I don't know, popularize clenbuterol, which was an asthma medication and steroid. He was one of the first to sort of bring out whey proteins. He mixed some crazy things, and the book tells some real horror stories about people who are willing to use their body as laboratory experiments. I mean, there's one scene where he recommended something called DNP, which is just one molecule away from TNT, as a fat burner to get somebody ready for a bodybuilding competition. It was a woman who got so hot, Bill, that she had to stand on a roof in the middle of the winter to cool down, and she still couldn't cool down. She almost died. So the book is filled with some of these fascinating, almost Frankenstein stories, not meant to scare, but to show how people who are on the fringe of this world, how far they'll go to try to rework their metabolism. It's really quite amazing. And that's why I think when you get through with the book, you realize that to some extent, Dan Duchesne, who a lot of people don't know, really almost belongs with Timothy Leary and Sigmund Freud in the influence that he's had.
Yeah, although a somewhat more dire influence over a somewhat larger number of people. If I read this correctly, at one point he's saying that people should go out and get themselves some paint remover and some Drano, and they'd be all set.
Oh my goodness, yeah, and that's that was, I think, to make GHB one of, you know, this is ultimately a cautionary tale, and it's a sad one because the further he got into the world, the more he needed to keep topping himself, and the more extreme he got. And here was a man who you meet in the early '80s, and he saw steroids as a drug without a constituency, and he was looking for himself. He was an ex-actor, and he wanted to make it his stage. And I write that he found in steroids a stage. He wanted to popularize a drug that he thought could turn men into supermen and heal the sick. And, you know, they can do that, but it's, as I say, Bill, drug of optimism and avarice. The further he got in the his life, the sadder and crazier he got, and it got a little freaky. I think that there will be people whose neck hairs will stand up when they see what some others are willing to do to themselves.
Dan Duchesne ultimately was perhaps the greatest cautionary tale against using one's body as a lab experiment, because he died quite young and aged hideously before that happened.
Yeah, I mean, in, you know, late 40s, early 50s, he was a man 30 years older. He had a disease called polycystic kidney disease, fluid-filled sacs on his kidneys, and that was a hereditary disease. But, you know, while it was unclear from the autopsy, it certainly stands to reason, especially considering he's got two surviving relatives who are older, that his steroid use and other use accelerated that disease. And I think that's a continuing danger of these drugs.
To what extent is the science of doping still ahead of the science of testing?
That's a great question. I think it's ahead. I think the chasm has been bridged greatly. With each new test that we have, and there's some very good ones for the oxygen blood booster, EPO, for anabolic steroids, for the Olympics in Beijing, they're promising a really good HGH test. We'll see. I think with each of these advances, the window closes. I think the distance was gaping the last 10 years ago. I don't think it's quite so gaping, but you know, I mean, there's always going to be a Victor Conti and there's always going to be a Balco out there.
You know, the promise of stricter testing for the Olympics in Beijing rings somewhat ironic, since China has a history of supplying steroids to the world.
Yeah, it's a real yin and a yang. I guess forgive the pun. I mean, one of the biggest law enforcement crackdowns just came in the last month. The American Drug Enforcement Administration took down more than 50 underground steroid labs that were found to be supplied by Chinese steroid factories. And I was in China, and I posed as a broker, and I was able to make orders for all sorts of steroids in kilogram quantities, human growth hormone, too. I mean, they just ship it FedEx. It's as easy as pie to get. It comes to your P.O. box, and boom, you mix it up in a bathtub in your basement. And, you know, if you're the wrong kind of person, you're dealing it out to high school kids. I mean, it's actually quite frightening. And at the same time, China's trying to put a face on, the best face to the world. I mean, they have a smile campaign. They're telling their citizens, don't spit. I mean, they're literally going to seed the clouds to make it blue skies and the Olympics look clean. So you have this astounding dichotomy. They're also investing greatly in drug testing. So they want a clean Olympics. At the very same time, their pharmaceutical industry is being accused of polluting our performance-enhancing landscape.
Given the politics of contemporary drug testing, do athletes like Tyler Hamilton and Floyd Landis strike you as credible when they maintain that the system is corrupt as well as mistake-prone?
Gosh, I really hate using them as examples. I mean, I was sat in Tyler Hamilton's living room in Boulder, Colorado, and he looked at me with his big, weepy blue eyes and told me how innocent he was. Guilty is charged. Floyd Landis, give me a break. Guilty is charged. Do they have some points about how the system needs to be opened up? Yes, but I tell you, Bill, I actually get nauseous listening to them paint themselves as martyrs for the cause.
Since the publication of your book, Marion Jones, who won lawsuits against people who said that she had doped and wrote that she had doped, has acknowledged that she did, in fact, use steroids over a period of some years. Will her confession change anything?
I hope so. By the way, I wrote first that she did it in 2004. She never sued me, so I was pretty, my back was pretty stiff. Yeah, look, I mean, here's the thing about Marion. Unlike Floyd or Tyler Hamilton, people believed in Marion, a lot of people. I mean, she really did touch hearts, and those hearts have been broken in a way that I haven't really seen in any other case. And, I do think that the detritus that she's left behind will have a positive effect. I just think that the next time somebody thinks about taking drugs to get on that stage and then the inevitable fall, they're going to think twice. I mean, maybe it's wishful thinking, but I hope that's going to be the case.
Sean Assale is the author of Steroid Nation, subtitled Juiced Home Runs, Anti-Aging Miracles, and A Hercules in Every High School, The Secret History of America's True Drug Addiction, published by ESPN Books. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Sean, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you so much, Bill.
My conversation with Sean Assale will be featured in Saturday's program. I'll also be talking to Tim Kirkjian about the World Series, of course, and Grant Wall will join me to talk about Major League Soccer's postseason. We'll have a story about China's contribution to the Milwaukee Bucks, Yi Jian Lian, and we'll explore the future of rock climbing in Kentucky. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.